So yeah, we change the scenery because you know the wife was thinking,
"What are
you
doing,
man?"
She's like, "Yo, this thing is taking long. What's going on?"
Because I told her, I was like, "Yeah, it'll only be an hour," and she's like, "This is like an hour and 45 minutes later."
Man, it's gonna be tough. You're gonna have a lot of editing in front of you, my friend.
I know, but if it's worth it, it's been so much fun.
Yeah, this has been a good one. This has been really fun.
Right, anyway, so where were we? So we got to.
So we were just before Guandu, I think.
Yeah. So, I think we already know like why Tao Tao and Yuan Shao were at heads with each other at this stage. Yuan Shao had managed to like conquer all of the territory north of the Yellow River, like within China proper at this stage. So, he conquered one of the like other prominent warlords in the area, a man named Gongsun Zan, and then of course, like it was just a matter of time before the two collided. And Tao Tao, he conquered everything south of the Yellow River, like more in the central plains area. Like he didn't get all the way to the Yangtze River yet, but he was getting there. A conflict was inevitable at this stage because these two warlords were extremely ambitious. And they knew there wasn't enough room for both of them, so a collision was going to happen. And when it came to the battle itself, so like it's like the battle itself is like really complicated, but basically, what happened in the year 199 was that Yuan Shao eventually launched his invasion, and the sources differ. But like some people say that Yuan Shao had over 1 million men, some people say he only had like 300,000 men, but a lot of them say he had around 700,000. So 700,000 men marching from his stronghold north of the Yellow River in Hubei province, which is actually quite close to Beijing, and he was marching south towards Tao Tao. And Tao Tao only, I think he had at the most, like from what I've read, about 200,000. Or 100,000. So it's like the difference is like at least 7 to 1, like if you're going to like compare the most extremes. So a 7 to 1 advantage to Yuan Shao, and everyone was thinking that Yuan Shao was going to win just based on the sheer number of men that he had. And then as well as that, Tao Tao's region had been plagued by, like locusts and stuff in the past few years. So the grain supply was a lot lower in his province to feed his army, whereas Yuan Shao didn't have that problem. Like all of his provinces were quite abundant in grain supply. So like he could supply his army for a very long time if he wanted to. So again, like it just goes to like everyone was just assuming Yuan Shao would win. But when the campaign kicked off and when Yuan Shao was marching his army, this is when, I suppose I better mention him now, Liu Bei, another ambitious warlord, comes into the fray. So, like, Liu Bei, he had been fighting for the Han Empire, like, he'd been fighting the Yellow Turbans. He started off as a militia against the Yellow Turbans, and then he got his own, like, province in Shu Province until Tao Tao took over. And then he came into the services of Tao Tao. But then, like, the emperor, as it goes anyway, the emperor, like, wrote an edict in blood towards Liu Bei to say to rebel against Tao Tao because he'd usurped power and to try and get away from him. So Liu Bei then, like, rebelled in Shu Province, which is what Tao Tao just conquered. So as Yuan Shao is approaching from the north, Liu Bei has rebelled to the east of Tao Tao's like stronghold. And Tao Tao then had to basically set up a defense force to Yuan Shao's army while he dealt with Liu Bei. And he set one of his generals, a man named Yu Jin, to stop Yuan Shao from like advancing across the Yellow River. And to be fair to Yu Jin, he does it quite well. He does like stop Yuan Shao from advancing. And in the meantime, Tao Tao completely annihilated Liu Bei's army. Like it was just like it wasn't even a close contest. Like Liu Bei took over the province, and then within a couple of months, Tao Tao completely rooted them out. And then this is when Liu Bei, after surviving, he then flees to Jing Province, and he comes under like the service of his cousin. And Again, this is like a little side note. This is apparently when Cao Cao recruits one of Liu Bei's sworn brothers, or like top generals, Guan Yu. And then it's Guan Yu who apparently helps Cao Cao defeat Wu Yuanshao's top two generals, Yan Lian and Wen Chou. But I mean, like, again, this is all part of the romance, so nobody really knows if it's like true or not. But anyway, getting to the battle itself. So when the two armies kind of collided, Cao Cao's victory came for like it came because of three factors. So the first one is that Cao Cao knew his enemy. He knew Yuan Shao, like he'd grown up with them. So he knew how Yuan Shao would behave. And because he knew how he'd behave, he knew exactly what he was going to do, and like he could predict the enemy's movements and counter them, which is what he did quite well. So for example, there's one time where Cao Cao's army, they're kind of like feigning a retreat, like his cavalry anyway, and what he does is he orders them to drop all of their belongings because he knows Yuan Shao will order his men to like, pick up all of the stuff. They want all the booty from the war. And he knows this, and which gives him time to like flee and rejoin his army. So again, it just goes to show Cao Cao knew his enemy very well when it came to this battle. And then, as well as this comes on to like the second point, which is Cao Cao was in charge of discipline, and he, like we already know, he disciplined his men very well. Whereas Yuan Shao, he couldn't really control his army that well. I mean, I can't blame Yuan Shao totally for that. He had an army of like at least 700,000. Like, it's pretty hard to control that many men.
No, I think you're right. Like, I mean, when you're dealing with numbers, and you know, I think Cao Cao will experience a bit of this later on as well. When you're incorporating as a warlord, when you're gaining new territories and incorporating military units from newly conquered territories, you certainly develop a large army. But a lot of these newly conquered people, they're not necessarily going to be the most loyal of the soldiers or the most dedicated of the soldiers. So I think you're right. There's a couple of accounts that I think Cao Cao, he clearly, like from a skilled, as a skilled general, he completely played Yuan Shao, like, I mean, like a fiddle. He certainly did. He knew he could foresee what he was going to do, and he knew how to apply it. But then he kind of used those superior numbers against Yuan Shao, which is hard to believe, right? You'd think when you're being outnumbered 7-1, that seems rather dismal. Talk about a probably destroying morale. But what Cao Cao does, and I know you're going to be kind of speaking towards this, really really is amazing, because he uses those numbers against him, and that's really hard to achieve when you're being that highly outnumbered. Wow, that is impressive.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is as well, like, I think it's always the case when you're defending, like, superior numbers isn't necessarily like the best thing to have. Like, if you're defending, you can concentrate your forces in defensive positions and just, take the enemy down as they come towards you. And like, Cao Cao did that against Yuan Shao as well. So like, there was plenty of incidents where Yuan Shao was like trying to like dig under the like the settlements and things, or like the city walls and things, and Cao Cao just knew it was happening and then just like countered it every single time. So whenever Yuan Shao tried something new, Cao Cao always had a counter for it. And it's demoralizing if you're attacking an enemy who knows what you're going to do. So it became this thing where like Yuan Shao was basically just throwing his men forward, trying to like get a breakthrough through sheer force of numbers, and Cao Cao just was like, yeah, bring it on, basically.
Oh yeah, and then you're also dealing with defections of generals going to opposite sides. I mean, that was a never-ending carousel. Adding to the chaos of different warlords arising, you have underlings and generals that go from one to the other to the other, and like, I mean, Liu Bei does that as well. Like, I mean, it's hard to find an example of one that just remains straight and narrow and true throughout that entire period, right? To one, like, dedicated to one. Like, I mean, Cao Cao actually, I mean, all things considered, I mean, he remains loyal to the Han to the end, right? Like, I mean, in fact, if you have to give it to one person, like, that amount of dedication was somewhat uncommon, really, given in that territory, in that region at the time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I suppose, like, Tal was true to himself in that way. And the only people who I could think of would be his subordinates, Xiao Houdun and Xiao Yuan. Like, they were the only ones who really stayed with, like, their one warlord throughout the entire time. Like, the rest of them, there was changing loyalties all the time. So, yeah. But, I mean, like, getting to the defection. So, nobody knows who exactly defected. There's two generals that come up a lot. One of them is called Zhang He, who plays an important role in Tao Ta's army later on. And the other one is, oh my god, I forgot his name. I completely forgot his name. It'll come back to me. But anyway, so like Zhang He is one of them, and then the other one is, I think it's Xu Yu. I think his name's Xu Yu. And basically, if you want to believe the story, like Yuan Shao, he's kind of like a paranoid ruler himself. And as a result of like some slandering, Yuan Shao basically tells this general, well, like, you're not long for this world, basically. So then this general goes, well, I could run to Tao Tao and, you know, everything's saved. And when this general goes to Tao Tao, he tells him where Yuan Shao's supplies are. And they're at a place called Wu Chao. So Tao Tao, being quite suspicious himself, he isn't sure about whether to trust the advice, but then he's basically got nothing to lose because, again, his supplies are running low. This is always, it's always been a problem for Tao Tao up until this stage. His supplies are always running quite low. So then he chooses, like, basically decides, I've got nothing to lose by going and seeing what the story is. So Tao Tao himself led the expedition to the supply depot. And rather than raiding it and trying to take the supplies for himself, he orders his men to burn it, which is quite brave. Because rather than taking the supplies for himself, he just says, no, they're going to be on the same boat as us. They're going to have no supplies. Burn them. So then his soldiers carry it out. And this is when, like, I think it's like played a huge morale shock to Yuan Shao's army more than it would have for Tao Tao's, because Tao Tao's men knew the situation. Whereas if you've got this, like, I don't know, security where you've got all this grain coming in, then all of a sudden it gets cut off, you'd be freaking out. And this is what happened within Yuan Shao's army. Like, everyone's freaking out about the lack of grain and things. Yeah. And then this is when Tao Tao then releases, like, well, I wouldn't say like a terror weapon or anything, but what he does is he cuts off the noses, the tongues, the ears. He gouges out the eyes of all of the dead soldiers in Yuan Shao's army. He even cuts off their heads and things and sends them all to Yuan Shao's army. And then that just, like, creates a panic. And then this is when he launches his final assault, and, like, Yuan Shao's army just breaks and everyone just basically takes for the hills.
Oh, yeah. When when you mentioned, like, I mean, this whole notion of 7-1, being outnumbered 7-1, Cao Cao could have certainly taken possession of some of the grain, but you're right, he did the best thing, the smartest move possible, because it was going to be 7 times more difficult for Yuan Shao to feed his troops without those. So that's where his masterful strategy, and it came into play, Cao Cao's at the very least. And then, because he did that twice, right? Like, I think there were two grain caches, two grain storages that Cao Cao made sorties against, and he had burned, and I think he was involved in both of those raids. And in both cases, like, by the time it hit that second one, Yuan Shao's forces, they were demoralized. I think Yuan Shao sent everyone to do, like, he ran out of options, so he tried one more last all-out attack on Guandu, but that was repulsed, and then he started heading away. And yeah, you're right. When Cao Cao, then, even with that, you know, most leaders would have been happy to see that massive army depart, but then he took the additional step of then attacking them as they were retreating and completely decimated Yan Chao's group. I mean, that was masterful with how he went up against him.
Yeah, it's like a stroke of genius, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Like, that's the best way you could just say it. It's like a stroke of genius. And then after the battle, like Yuan Shao's power is completely gone, basically, and then Yuan Shao's like on the defensive the entire time. And what's surprising is that Yuan Shao dies, but he didn't name an heir amongst his sons, and this created a huge power struggle between all of Yuan Shao's sons. I think it was four of them, and Tao Tao plays all of them. So he offers his like daughter in marriage to one of them, like Yuan Tan, whilst the others are getting ignored and things. So then Yuan Tan becomes an ally and lets Tao Tao in. But then this is when Tao Tao says, okay, you're not marrying my daughter. You're dead now. And then he like basically trampled his way through the north and like conquered like all of northern China, like through playing the brothers against each other. And then eventually the brothers did go to like Xiongnu allies like way up in the north for help, and then Tao Tao chased them down, like he didn't let them breathe. And I suppose this shows his ruthless like side again, because he just says, no, I'm not letting you off, there's no way that you're going to be allowed to like raise an army in the north and then come back, not a chance. So then eventually, and again this is when he uses his diplomacy, he tells these tribes in the north, like, give us the Yuan brothers, and then we'll not touch you. You don't touch us, and we're fine. Like, there's a clear border between us, and then the tribes happily oblige. And
And when I was kind of taking a look at this as well, and when I was doing my research on Cao Cao, I couldn't help but draw another parallel again with Philip of Macedon, where when I looked at this whole notion of the Battle of Guangdu and what this meant, like this was the moment where Cao Cao came into being the absolute power in northern China. It didn't happen immediately at that point, but that was it. As soon as he won there, it was inevitable that he was going to take everything. Like he knew how to divide the sons and use their kind of internal squabbles against one another to obtain ultimate power. So sometimes it comes down to that one defining battle. I mean, Philip had something really similar, and it was called the Battle of Chaeronea in 338 BCE. That was his crowning achievement. That's when he kind of crested the hill of making Macedon the absolute power in Greece. When it had started so many years back as just being a second-rate power with hardly a military... with hardly a military power to speak of, right? Very, very limited. And he took on, in this battle, he took on a Greek alliance. In this battle, he took on a Greek alliance that was led by Athens and Thebes. And he completely destroyed their armies. He skilled military leadership and skilled generalship on a completely overwhelming scale in that battle. He only saw losses of about 140 troops of Macedonian soldiers, whereas on the Greek side, on the Greek side it was in the thousands, and he had a numerically smaller force, and through that battle of Chaeronea, that set him up as Macedon as the Greek hegemon, and at that point he was the unassailable power in Greece, and those were two defining moments for each of them. And you know, it's funny because you keep on going back to this because they seem so different. We're talking about different time frames, different parts of the world, yet there are some really interesting connections that one cannot help but draw parallels on, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's crazy. I never knew, because I've heard of the battle, but I never knew the scale of the losses for the Athenian side. That is crazy.
Yeah. And it was just based on strategy. He knew how to play it. He understood how their armies, how their hoplites worked. And that's what he built his army around against. He built it as being the complete opposite. Hoplites were general purpose troops, pretty much the only way, the sole means by through which most of the Greek world won and lost their battles holistically for centuries leading up to that point. Whereas Philip, he created his army, each unit with a specific tactical purpose, right? So not a jack of all trades approach. He used each piece as a different puzzle, but they had to work in symphony together. And so he displayed it in Chaeronea, and that was the moment where he became the absolute power, and just as Cao Cao did with Guandu.
Yeah, because I mean, like, it's strange, because with all of these warlords, like, throughout history, there's always that one defining battle, you know? There's always that battle that just, like, catapults their fame. We're just, like, there's always that stroke of genius in there somewhere. You're just, like, that is amazing how they won that battle. I mean, of course, like, it's a shame because people lost their lives in the battle and things, but I mean, when you look at the tactical, like, the tactics behind it, you're just, like, it's amazing. Like, you can't take away from that, so to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, we have the benefit we have the benefit of seeing it, you know, we're so far removed from it, but it doesn't take away the brilliance, right? I guess the travesty of it, it doesn't hit as much because it's so distant to where we are, right?
Yeah, and I mean, again, like, I mean, it's survival, isn't it? Like, so, like, if Philip didn't win the battle, then, like, the Athenians probably would have dominated Greece again, and like, if Cao Cao lost the Battle of Guandu, then Yuan Shao would have dominated northern China. So it's just like one of those things, it's survival.
Absolutely correct. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So this is when, like, Cao Cao really did reach the peak of his power, just because there wasn't really any other warlords who could challenge his authority, really. I mean, you had, like, Sun Quan in the south, that was about it. Because Liu Bei was, like, like, he's one of the three kingdoms, but he hasn't even established his kingdom yet. Like, he's still a vassal of his cousin, Liu Biao. And this is where Cao Cao turns his attention to next. He turns to Jing province, which is, it's strategically vital in terms of, like, if you want to invade from the north to the south, you need to go through Jing province. So it's clear to see why Cao Cao wanted to go there next. Mm-hmm. And he was quite lucky in the sense that Liu Biao, he was old, and then he died. And again, it's internal squabbling between his two sons because he didn't choose an heir. And Cao Cao took advantage of it and then steamrolled through the province. And there's a really famous battle where it's called the Battle of Chamban. Like, I don't know if you heard about it, but this is when Liu Bei, he's like a supporter of one of Liu Biao's sons, and he's fleeing to try and get, like, as far south as possible. And Cao Cao is, like, trying to catch him with his elite cavalry units, and then they catch Liu Bei's forces at the Battle of Chamban. And it's here where, again, you've got a lot of romanticized, like, stories and things where one of Liu Bei's brothers, Zhang Fei, he roars so loud that a guy dies and all that kind of nonsense. Just like okay. But surprisingly, Liu Bei, like, because, like, Cao Cao's, like, closing in on, like, his, it's almost like Liu Bei, like, as much as he's not powerful, he is in a way, just because he is, he's almost like the anti-Cao Cao, so to speak, because everything that Cao Cao is, Liu Bei isn't. So, like, that's where Liu Bei's drawn his fame from. So, like, Cao Cao's seen as oppressive, Liu Bei's seen as the, you know, the man of the people, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, this is when, like, Liu Bei, he's fleeing, and a lot of people from Jin province, they try and flee with his army, and, like, they're getting caught between Liu Bei's and Cao Cao's forces. And eventually, they catch him at the Battle of Chamban, but then Liu Bei's forces manage to, like, kind of stave off Cao Cao's army, and then they escape. Like, they manage to cross the Yangtze River, and then this is where Cao Cao has to stop. What this does, though, is that it does set up Cao Cao for, like, this is when he's, like, truly at the height of his power. Like, everyone just thinks it's a matter of time before Cao Cao unites China. Which sets him up nicely for the Battle of Red Cliff. The problem is, though, that Cao Cao's a very good commander in terms of land forces, but when it comes to naval, like, battles and things, he's got no experience. Whereas the people in the south, and particularly in Dongwu, which is, like, Sun Quan's province, they know all about sailing. They grew up in the Yangtze River, so they know all about naval warfare, which, it doesn't bode well for Cao Cao in that sense. Like, and again, it's like what you mentioned earlier, like, because, like, Cao Cao's army was, like, I think when he tried to invade at the Battle of Red Cliff, it was something like 800,000 men he had. Some people say he had 1 million, and then others, like, try and, like, bring it right the way down to earth again, where they say he only had, like, 400,000. But a lot of these men, they had just been put into his army, so they would have questioning loyalty towards like Tao Tao and his forces. Whereas the coalition of Liu Bei and Sun Quan, they were all loyal to their lords, and they all knew what the story was. Like, they knew if they lost, then that was it was game over. So they were fighting more so for their lives rather than Tao Tao's army, so to speak. And this is where Tao Tao's power begins to, well, I wouldn't say decline, but yeah, this is when
at least it gets checked. Yeah, you're right. That's what I would agree, because he certainly, even beyond that point, even beyond this point, which ends up as a resounding loss for him, he still exhibits power when he goes back north, and he still has a lot more work that he intends to do beyond this point. But you're right, there was when looking at the Battle of Red Cliff, he outnumbered obviously the opposing forces significantly, but there was other stuff. Like, he was not a naval commander for sure. But I know his forces were tired from marching. There were northerners as well, so they weren't used to the climate. There was disease that was starting to spread among his troops. They were getting seasick on the river, on the boats that they was bringing along the Yangtze River. The thing is, understanding all these concerns, and I'm confident understanding Cao Cao as the general, he was aware that these things were unfolding within his army, right? Some of the troops were of questionable loyalty. Do you think that it was just he had a golden opportunity, right? If he was able to win here, he would have, you know, he would have had a huge hand in terms of gaining the South. So the opportunity was just too good to pass up. Do you think he should have known better, understanding all these problems that were besetting his army? Do you think he should have known better, being the masterful general he was?
Yeah, I would think so. Like, I would think that he should have known better. Because during my summer holidays there, I did travel from Beijing to the south, and man, the difference, it's unbelievably hot. And like, it's really humid and stuff. So in terms of like seeing it myself, I could see why the soldiers were getting sick and things when they were going towards like the Battle of Red Cliff. But I mean, as well as that, like Tao Tao, he was hoping, because he did know that within Sun Quan's ranks, within his own ministers and things, a lot of them wanted peace. They didn't want a war. It was only Sun Quan who was, you know, like saying, no, we're fighting out. And it's because Sun Quan had the most to lose. Mm-hmm. Like, Tao Tao wouldn't let Sun Quan keep his post.
Yeah.
Whereas he would probably have let everyone else keep their post in that regard. So, I think Tao Tao was trying to bide his time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, being there just made everyone aware that, you know, this huge army's on our doorstep and, like, we can't do anything about it, so to speak. But then, of course, there was this brilliant strategy by Zhou Yu, like, the head of Sun Quan's army. And from, like, this is, like, fact. So the general Huang Gai came up with the idea. He did say, how about I pretend to defect towards Tao Tao, and when I do defect, like, that's when I'll light my ships on fire and, you know, like, we'll set his fleet ablaze. And the reason why they did this is because they knew the northerners were getting seasick on the Yangtze River.
Yeah.
So in order to combat that seasickness, they chained all their ships together so it felt like they were on land. Which is, it seems like a good idea, but if, you know, you're going to get a fire attack against you, it's a very bad idea.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Because, I mean, that was it, right? As soon as they let go of those fire ships and they hit that chained up linkage of all those ships that were under Cao Cao, that was it. That dashed his objectives of going further south. But I mean, the thing is, it was a gamble that he was intending to take, just because it was too good of an opportunity. This was his opportunity to bring the south to its knees. Had he won this victory here, that's it. He may have very well unified China, right? He may have very well have done that. But I mean, he was getting on in age too, and he probably was like, you know, okay, maybe it was a calculated gamble, but he must have been aware that all these problems were, granted, that's not what sunk him. What sunk him was the defection, right? The Or the dupe getting duped with that defection and the fire ships coming into his fleet.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think you're right, without a doubt. If Tao Tao won, he would have, like, unified China. Just because, like, his main competitor was Sun Quan and Liu Bei. And if he wiped both of them out, like, with one battle, then that would have been it. It would have been game over. Yeah. So, like, when you look at it that way, when the stakes are that high, you're just thinking, well, you could see why he stayed there. And, I mean, the story goes that, again, like, this is from the Three Kingdoms, that Zhou Yu actually planted a spy within Tao Tao's army, and he was the one who suggested that Tao Tao should chain his ships together in order to, like, you know, bring the plan into motion where he could use a fire attack. But again, that's all, like, speculative. It's all part of the romance.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, the thing is, after this, like, huge defeat where Tao Tao, like, lost all of, like, basically his entire army who'd been with them since the start, what's remarkable is that he goes back to Xuchang, he's humbled, but then he doesn't stop, like you said. Like, he then focuses more on the economy within his own realm and tries to consolidate his power within the north rather than trying another offensive within the south. I think it's because he had the foresight. He knew that there's no point in even trying to invade again. You might as well just defend, because when it came to the populations and things within China at that time, most of the population was in the north. And, like, all of the grain supply, or the majority of it, was in the north. And he knew that. So he just knew it was a matter of time before the north would unify against the south. So, like, he was just thinking, well, I'll basically set everything up for my descendants to do the work that I couldn't have, basically.
Yeah, and you're right, and probably the warlords from the south. Like, I mean, look where we started off. At one point, there were, you know, I don't know the exact number. This would be a bit of a shot in the dark, but hundreds of warlords, you know, regional warlords vying for power. Now you're down to three main guys, right? You have Cao Cao in the north. You have Liu Bei in the south, southwest, I guess. And then you have Sun Quan in the southeast. And even the guys in the south, they must have had a sense of that as well. Because the lines somewhat stabilize between the north and south at this point, right? Like, no one's really going hard. Like, there's still some battles. I understood that between the north and the south. But the lines somewhat stabilize, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, nobody really conquers any new territory until Sima Yi, usurps power from the Taos, and then the Jin Dynasty gets involved. But, like, what happens after the Battle of Redcliffe is that it sets the stage for the Three Kingdoms. So it's quite ironic because, like, it was Sun Quan's army who did most of the work in terms of dealing with Tao Tao and defeating him, but it's Liu Bei who gets all of the benefits, because then he takes over Jin Province, and then from Jin Province he then launches an attack to the west against Liu Zhang, and then that's, like, modern day Sichuan Province and stuff. So then Liu Bei then conquers the southwest, and what Tao Tao does is, rather than, like, fighting them and, like, trying to, like, you know, get Jing Province back or anything, he knows that the court for Sun Quan is really unhappy that Liu Bei has actually benefited from the battle. So, like, he knows there's a matter of time before they two start fighting each other, which is what happens. So, like, it's like it becomes, like, almost like a triangular system of backstabbing and political maneuvering and things, and, like, all three powers are, like, trying to get one up on each other, pretending that they're allies, and then going against each other and things. And then this is, you know, that's what the Three Kingdoms was all about.
Yeah, definitely. And during that time, I understand that Cao Cao, that beyond this point, this is when he's getting some of the really remarkable titles and bestowments all kind of, like, lifetime achievement awards for everything that he's done. He becomes the Duke of Wei. From the north, he's given the nine bestowments, and then at some point, I believe he's claims the title of King of Wei as well. I think very late in his career, right?
Yeah. So, like, this is when, because, like, he basically he's just on the defensive now, and again, it's because he's building up his economy and making sure that his descendants will finish the job, basically. Like, that's his goal now. And again, he's still got the emperor in his pocket, and the all of Tao Tao's ministers are saying, "Oh yeah, you need to give Tao Tao these like the 9 bestowments, which is like it's like the top title. So it's like you're almost like officially at the same level as an emperor, and then King of Wei as well. So it's like it's just like everyone knows the emperor has no power whatsoever. It's just a matter of time before he's usurped, and." The only, like, the biggest aggressor against Tao Tao, like, later on was Liu Bei. Like, which is surprising because Liu Bei was in the southwest. That's probably, like, the least populated area in China at the time. So, like, the fact that he kept on launching invasions against Tao Tao is quite surprising. And then this is, of course, like, if Tao Tao then dies, and then this is when Tao Pi takes over and he finishes the job in terms of usurping the Han throne in, I think it was 220 AD. This is when...
In 220, yeah. So I have a question. I have a question for you that's been burning that I, ever since you and I determined that we were going to talk about this, as soon as I understood this, there's a burning question that I haven't been able to get out of my mind. So his son gives him the title... beyond his death as Grand Ancestor Emperor Wu of Wei. So do you think that Cao Cao would have approved of this? Do you think, because I mean, the reason that I'm asking this is because throughout his career, he made it known that he would, and he had so many opportunities to do so. He never usurped the role of emperor. He never usurped the throne officially. Like he did so never truly in name. Do you think that he would have approved his son doing so?
I think so. Just because he did set everything up for power to be usurped. And I think that, I remember I read somewhere, like, Tao Tao did this intentionally. And it's just because he spent his whole life or his early career fighting in the name of the Han. So he felt it was inappropriate for him to officially usurp power from the Han Empire. So then he left it all to his son to do it.
So here is where this speaks to, again, a weird coincidence with linking up Philip of Macedon to Cao Cao, right? Like, so Philip's undoing or his death took place when he was assassinated in 336, right? We don't know who did it. Could have been his wife, Olympias. It could have been his son, Alexander the Great. It could have been from the many Greek enemies he had or that of the Persians, because he made it no secret that his next plans were to attack Persia. But like Cao Cao, who never saw that unification of China, though it would follow in time, Philip didn't get to live to see the Persians defeated, right? That was, though he was the original reason, he was the reason that this eventually transpired. There's a strong connection there, right? Because like Cao Cao, he set up everything for that to occur. Philip set everything up for that to occur, eventually conquering that of the Persian Empire. But there's a strong connection there because they never, each of them died before their ability to see that happen. But it was ultimately achieved on both accounts, right? Through their sons.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, Tao Pi, I think Tao Pi's biggest flaw, well, it wasn't his biggest flaw, because, like, he emulated his father, where he used the most capable ministers to, you know, like, help him unify China. But the problem was, the most capable minister at the time was a man named Sima Yi. And Sima Yi was, like, even Tao Tao told his son, watch out for him because he's ambitious. And Tao Pi was like, he was aware of him, like he did try his best. But the problem was when the kingdom of Shu Han kept on launching attacks, so this is like known as Zhuge Liang's like 5 northern campaigns. When Shu Han's attacking Wei, the only person who could defeat Zhuge Liang was Sima Yi. So then Sima Yi's fame rose through like the Tao Wei's support, so to speak. And then, of course, like, Tao Pi dies prematurely, And then his, I think it was his son or something like that, he's an incompetent fool. And then the Tal family, they're trying to like oust Sima Yi. And then, of course, like later on, Sima Yi pretends that he's insane and things. And then the Tals let their guard down. And then this is when Sima Yi launches a coup and takes over. And then, like, it's weird because Tal Tal used the Han Emperor as a puppet. And then later on, Sima Yi, who served Tal Tal, used one of his descendants as a puppet. And then, like, he did exactly the same thing. So he didn't usurp power himself, but his grandson did, like, later on.
Yeah, there are so many instances of that, like, among the warlords like that, that even I've researched for sure. So many instances of them not having that legitimacy and yet having the talent, right? Again, emerging out of these chaotic times and then finding the appropriate puppet, right? That was always such, that always plays such a central theme whenever you have new people rising to the helm, right? Arising to that notion of leadership. It's amazing how often that happens. It's that, and unfortunately it happens to a lot of people when they are children taking the throne, right? They're surrounded by people who want to, you know, identify an easy target to rule through. And that unfortunately is, in many cases, it ends up in pretty terribly for a lot of those involved, with the exception of maybe that one warlord.
In fact, that I love there's a YouTube channel like Oversimplified. I love what they say about that. So like they do a Three Kingdoms episode, and then like there's a point where there's like a young emperor, and then he goes, like, so basically like a bunch of eunuchs approach the emperor and say, "Hey, let us run the empire for you. I mean, help you run the empire."
It's so true. Well, yeah, this story, holy moly, like Tao Tao's story, it's rife with that. There's so many people taking power through puppets. It's unreal.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
So true.
So, I mean, like that, I mean, I suppose that would sum up like Tal Tal's military career. Like, he did consolidate his power after the Battle of Red Cliff. He did like defeat warlords to the west of him. They were called Hansui and Ma Chao. Like, he defeated them in the west. But then after that, he just kind of tried to like focus on stability and the economy. And then this is when his political philosophy really, like, you know, everyone can see it for what it was. Like, even if they didn't see it before, they definitely know what it is now. And that is legalism. So, like, I don't know if you've heard of legalism, but that's, like, so it's, like, it's basic. The only way I could really describe it is that it's heavily focused on reward and punishment. Like, that's it. So, like, legalism is a philosophy where, like, the man who came up with it, it wasn't Han Feize, but he's one of like the perpetrators of it. He basically says all humans are bad, and the only thing that you could do to stop them from being bad is reward them for when they're good, and then punish them for when they're bad. So it's like, do you know, like the donkey with the carrot and the stick? That's the best way I could describe it. So Tal Tal was all about that. He was all about that, whereas China at that time, especially the Han court, they were all Confucius scholars, so they hated this. And they were all like referring back to the days of the Qin dynasty, like Qin Shi Huang, where he was a legalist and he had like a brutal reign where, you know, people really hated the central government, so to speak. And then as soon as he died, everyone rose up in rebellion. So Tal Tal had a lot on his hands when it came to rebellions and stuff. Loads of people tried to assassinate him. And it's no surprise then that he was particularly suspicious of everyone. So, like, if you said the wrong thing in front of him, he would then immediately be suspicious of you, and then you would disappear quite quickly. And then the thing is with, like, China, like, I'm pretty sure this happened in, like, you know, ancient Macedonia and, like, ancient Greece and things. If one minister is, you know, perceived as being guilty of being treasonous, then the entire family has to go. And this is what happened in China. So, like, it's not just, like, you know, the individual. It's his family and then his extended family all get wiped out. So it's, like, the entire clan just get wiped out.
Yeah, well, it's... Sorry, on that one, I don't have a thought on that one. I'm trying to think of, let's see. Yeah, I'm not too sure on the Macedonian side whether that was the case where the entire family would be branded as kind of the perpetrator as a result of one of their ancestors. Nothing that immediately comes to mind there. But one of the things that I think you pointed out, that it just his lasting legacy or his lasting character, I'm referring to Cao Cao, that is completely on that legal side of things, right? Like, he was an ardent believer in that, and he followed that to a degree. That's kind of his moral compass, even though that's probably a large part of his vilification as well, right? People saw his the way he was pursuing things, and he would use anything at his disposal to achieve his gains, even if that meant ruthlessly destroying whomever, right? But it was creating order in this world of chaos. That's using this whole strategic vision. That's what these people are masterful at, right? And that's what allowed him ultimately to rise to where he did, to rise to the top and the absolute top that no one could assume higher, even though it happened after his death. He still achieved it, right? So yeah, he still gets credit for the title.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the thing is as well, like, Cao Cao knew his history, like when it came to China, and he probably looked at the state of Qin during the Warring States era, and the state of Qin was legalist, and because they were legalist, they like rose to power and then conquered all of the other Warring States within like 5 years or something, or definitely within 10, which is like a huge achievement. It had never been done before, and it was because of this philosophy. But of course, the problem with this philosophy is that it's very good for gaining power, it's just that it's not good for maintaining it. And Cao Cao was even seeing that in his lifetime, where like people were rebelling against him just because they knew like the implications of going back to a legalist state, which is what he was pursuing. I mean, to be fair to Cao Cao, I think if he had unified China, he probably would have laxed on it a little bit and probably would have brought in more Confucian ideas and things, but just for the terms of like gaining power and, you know, like keeping himself there, like he like adhered to legalism basically.
I think you have a point there, because I know early on in his career, when he was fighting the Yellow Turban Rebellion, at one point, he, in order to kind of squash it, he was ruthlessly, though, enforcing ideals of Confucianism and destroying temples, associations, anything dealing with any other cult. Granted, he did it in an exceedingly ruthless manner, like belligerently, right? And that created a lot of enemies, but you might have something there, because he was readily intent on following that path, on getting it to, from a religious standpoint, supporting that state religion of Confucianism.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those things, like, I think, because, like, I mean, like, he's a strategic man, so to speak, so I don't think his idea of, like, political philosophy and everything would really get in the way to him controlling power, so to speak. So if he had lived longer, like and if he had unified China, I reckon he might have went towards more Confucian ideas and like tried to rule the state through kindness. But I mean, he probably, like in his early career, he probably did look at Confucianism and say, well, this is the result of it, all of the corruption and things that was going on in the Eastern Han Dynasty. And then, of course, you know, like, look where that got you. So he's probably trying to like look back at like the glory days of the Qin, even though the Qin lasted like 15 years and the Han Dynasty lasted 400. So, I mean, you've got to think about the math there.
Yeah, you're right. But I guess the other part of it, or the other lesson that comes out of it, is that every dynasty falls eventually, right? Everyone, as solid as it was initially, like, I mean, the Han Dynasty, if I'm not mistaken, was considered, for at least a large portion of its time, the golden, like one of the golden ages of Chinese history, right? but even within that whole notion, eventually it started to degrade, and the court culture started to get infested with corruption and problems. I mean, these things eventually you get so strong or an empire gets so established that it almost becomes somewhat complacent, right? And then all these insidious notions of squabbling for power amongst those that are remaining during largely peaceful times. And then that's when they take their eye off the ball, the populace starts to suffer, and then rebellions start to arise.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say, like, time is the biggest killer of any great empire. Like, any empire in history, it's always time that usually kills it. Like, it's a victim of its own success, almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is, I think that's right on, yeah.
The last story that I'll get to, I mean, it's like a two-hour podcast now. But the last story that I'll get to is, it's quite tragic, actually, because it goes to, again, it goes back to, like, Tal Tal's suspicious nature when he was in power. And his suspicious nature actually led to the death of one of China's, like, greatest doctors ever. He's, like, known as one of the top four doctors in Chinese history. And his name is Hua Tuo. And it's a shame because Hua Tuo, he was a victim of the circumstance, so to speak, because he, like most doctors at the time, he travelled where he was needed, and usually that was the front lines. And it just so happened that Liu Bei's brother, Guan Yu, was attacking Tao Tao's army in Jin province. And as the story goes, Guan Yu was shot with a poison arrow, and the doctor treated his arm. And there's a whole story behind it. Like, apparently, it was a very painful procedure, and Guan Yu continued to play chess as if nothing was happening, like, to show how strong he was, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so he treats Guan Yu, and then he moves north towards Wei. And then this is when he comes across Tao Tao's territory. And Tao Tao, throughout his life, was suffering from, like, severe headaches, especially whenever he got angry. And then the doctor, when he was called there, diagnosed it as a brain tumour. And he was actually correct. So, like, it's amazing, like, what, 2,000 years ago, like, a doctor knew what a brain tumour was. And just, like, so the doctor proposed this procedure where he would, you know, make Tao Tao go unconscious or put him to sleep for a while, and then he would, like, cut a hole in his head and remove the tumor and then seal it up again. But of course, Tao Tao, being the suspicious ruler that he was saying that is not happening. He was furious, and it didn't help matters that this doctor just treated, like, one of his most bitter enemies. So the doctor got thrown in jail. And
wow.
With getting thrown in jail, the doctor, like, he knew he was going to die. Like, he knew there was no escape for him. Like, because he just proposed, like, some suicide attempt to save Tao Tao's life. So he tried to save his work. So he pleaded with the guard guarding the cell, saying, "Look, please, just take my work. I don't care, where you put the book. Just hide the book and then, like, give it to another doctor, like, later on." Because all of his work was in there. All of the healing rituals and all of the herbs and stuff that, like, all the data that he collected over his life was in this book. So it was like his life treasure, so to speak. But then the guard took the book, but fearing for, you know, his life, because if anybody else seen him taking that book, he would then get accused of, like, collaborating with the doctor. So then he would get killed. So then he burned the book, which is quite sad. It's quite tragic. And then, of course, the doctor died. And then later on, the brain tumour that, you know, the doctor diagnosed killed Tao Tao in the end as well, which is quite a sad story when you think of it.
That is absolutely a sad story. And as you were saying it, that's one, again, that I had not heard of. When I researched it, the only kind of information I understood is he had some type of head disease. So I did not know. That's amazing that the fact that this is almost 2,000 years ago, that they're finding out that, like, is aware of tumors. Like, I mean, that is unreal. I had no idea they had that type of knowledge at that point. But it's actually very unfortunate, considering, just made me think of all the collateral damage that comes with these times of upheaval, of these times of chaos that occurs. Like, think about within that view, the Yellow Turban Rebellion, all these people that were just caught in the crossfire, right? I mean, and this is something that you see in upheaval, any kind of rise to power of any powerful leader or warlord, there's all these countless other casualties, and how, like, how much vital information like this was lost within the folds. It's that's, I guess, one of the sad things to think about when you consider these types of events.
Yeah, I know. It's sad. It is. Because, like, I mean, this is the problem as well. Like, when a Chinese, like, dynasty gets established, they try and remove all of the good things about the previous dynasty. So,
lots of things
just get lost. And, I mean, like, I could imagine it'd be the same in Greece. Like, when people get conquered, a lot of the precious artifacts or, like, the knowledge that's established, you know, it all just disappears.
Yeah, they would not only take everything and just use those riches, but then they'd want to impose their culture on it. Like, that was one thing that Philip was doing. Like, he kind of took Greek culture to a certain degree, that whole notion of Hellenism, and that's something that Alexander applied to, you know, when he went marauding off into Asia. It was a huge, that was the growth, the spread of Hellenism globally, right? And that's why it became so pervasive, included in all these different areas as it is, even to this day, right? You see elements of it.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, there was, like, lots of Hellenistic cities popping up throughout, like, Central Asia and things, like, even after Alexander died. Like, they were still there.
Absolutely. And that continued, actually, for a number of years, right? And that was excuse me. Yeah, and that's something that has lasted. That's actually been a legacy of a lot of these times of upheaval. Anytime you have these big changes in power and then you have someone that starts marauding off and conquering others, that it just a lot of things get lost in the fold, and a lot of new things get implemented, new ways of believing, new ways of acting, religions, belief systems, so many different aspects of that.
Yeah, I know, it's sad, but I mean, like, I think it's going to be a theme throughout human history as a whole, really, isn't it? Like, times of chaos, there'll be something like lots of great things will get lost.
Yeah, well, but sometimes on the flip side, that's where you see some of these brilliant strategists emerge as well. Because I don't want to end off things on such a sad note for your listeners here, right? I want to try to breathe some some life back into it. But, like, these are the times that create it so invigorating for us, right? As people that are interested in history, these are these chaotic times are when you have these people that emerge that are larger than life and somehow figure out a way to navigate these storms, right? And create something entirely new that it's hard not to admire as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And, like, Tao Tao and, like, Philip II are two shining examples of that, just, like, how people can adapt and survive and, you know, overcome these, like, huge challenges. It's just amazing. But I think we'll need to wrap it up there. Because, I mean, it's getting to 12 o'clock. Well, it's getting to midnight here now.
Yeah,
you're
going to sleep, man. Yeah.
It's just as well as the summer holiday for me. So I don't have to worry about work tomorrow. So I'm okay.
That's good. Well, that's glad to hear. I must say, dude, this was it was an absolute pleasure to connect with you today. I loved our conversation. It's funny when we both started talking about this, comparing Philip II of Macedon to Cao Cao seemed like such an outlandish idea, but it was awesome to kind of have fun with this and just start comparing them. I thought it was really, really fun. So, I just want to thank you again. Thank you so much for having me on. Absolute pleasure on my side.
Oh, well, thank you. Like, thank you for coming onto the show. It was great. And hopefully we could do this again. So next time, you know, we could talk about someone else, like, maybe focus more on what you've been doing rather than what I've been doing.
No, that sounds good, and definitely I'd love to take you up on that, and I'm sure we'll be connecting again on this for sure.
Yeah, well, thank you very much again, Mark, and I hope you have a lovely day.
You as well. It's a pleasure, and thank you again.
Yeah, all right, thank you very much. All right, bye-bye.
Thanks.